That's the stuff that sticks in there.
Join me, Ophira Eisenberg, for NPR's guiltiest and most puzzling pleasure.
Saturday morning at 11 on AM 580.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. We'd like to start the program today talking about a term you may or may not have heard, the bamboo ceiling, like the so-called glass ceiling, which refers to women who, despite their qualifications, don't seem to get to the top ranks of their fields. Bamboo ceiling refers to the barrier some Asian American professionals believe that they face when trying to reach leadership roles in the workplace. According to Diversity Inc., Asian Americans make up only 2.6% of the corporate leadership of Fortune 500 companies. This despite the fact that Asian Americans have the highest levels of education and income in the country. We wanted to talk more about this, so we've called upon Linda Akutagawa. She is the president and CEO of Leadership Education for Asian Pacifics, or LEAP. This is a group that conducts leadership training for Asian American executives and also consults with corporations on these issues. Linda, welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Great. Thanks for having me.
Also joining us is writer Wesley Yang, who's written at length on this issue. Wesley, thank you for coming as well.
Hi, Michelle.
So, Linda, let's start with you. I think people are familiar with the idea of the glass ceiling. Is the bamboo ceiling essentially the same idea?
Yes, very much so.
What's the evidence of it?
Well, I think if you look in terms of education and, as some would say, the representation just in terms of looking at where Asian Americans are in corporate America in the workforce, and why is it that if there can be so many people who have the education as well as, I would say, even the skills and the abilities, why they aren't better represented. But that applies across the board to a lot of people of color as well as women as well, too. But definitely, I think there's a misperception that Asian Americans are perhaps much better represented at those senior-most levels. But our numbers really show it. You mentioned the 2.6% board representation. Yet if you look at population numbers, we're about 6%. Then if you start comparing it to the representation in an average number at different companies, let's say, even if you use 5 to 10%, we're still underrepresented.
Can each of you in your work has asked yourselves some hard questions? So I think that we should be able to do that as well. So Linda, do you think that this is racism or is it something else?
I think it could be a combination of many different things. I won't say that it's only the structure, but there is, I think, a baked-in kind of assumption of what leaders are supposed to look like, what leaders are supposed to act like. And when it's different, then people sometimes have a hard time seeing beyond that, and it really takes someone who can look beyond that. At the same time, when we're working with our populations, our community, we're also asking them hard questions as well, too. What are you doing to understand the organizational culture? What are you doing to build the relationships that you do need to have to be able to be seen as a viable candidate?
Wesley, what about you? What do you think?
I think that if we sort of, there's a traditional assumption that racism is about overt hatred and or a conscious policy of discrimination that's designed to keep some people out or to keep some people down. And first of all, the empirical predicate here is that the further you go in almost any institution in American life, profit or nonprofit, sort of, but especially in Fortune 500 corporate America, which is the area where LEAP operates, the further you go up within an organizational structure, the more white and male, the less minority and female those organizations almost all become. And to me, it's really a matter of like small daily transactions that exact a toll on women and minorities that reproduce a power structure without there being sort of like an overt intention to keep women and minorities out. So I want to give you a very simple and clear example of how this functions. A friend of mine was an associate at an elite white shoe New York City law firm, and there was a complicated case the partner was involved in, and he was in the process of dividing up the work between three associates, and he said to my friend Ken, who was Chinese-American, Ken, you were an engineer, right? You take on this part of the case, and he proceeded to give him an enormously difficult and technical set of complicated technical questions to answer. Now, Ken was an English major in college, and one of the associates, a white guy, had been a math major, but the math major was happy to take on the less technically difficult part of the assignment, and Ken had to struggle with the math.
I was going to ask you whether Ken had been an engineer, and you're saying no. I just want to make sure that everybody heard that Ken was not an engineer.
So was Ken the victim of racism? Yeah. You know, probably not in the sense that we think of when we think of Donald Sterling's racism, but it's probably more accurate to say that he was a victim of a kind of misrecognition that was possibly, but not necessarily provably, the result of stereotypes that the partner carried with him. Now, this is a minor incident, but if you iterate this over time, you can see how the constant iteration of minor advantages can turn into major disparate outcomes when you project it, extrapolate it over the course of 5 or 10 years, say.
Well, you know, can I ask each of you about this? Because, again, both of you have grappled with this question yourself. And Linda, I'll start with you on this. The data most often cited on this question, and if you're just joining us, we're talking about something called the bamboo ceiling. That's the barrier that some Asian Americans believe that they face when it comes to executive level or leadership roles. We're talking about this with Linda Akutagawa of the Leadership Education for Asian Pacifics and freelance writer Wesley Yang. The data, Linda, that's often cited in this question of the disparity about where Asian Americans should be compared to where they are when it comes to leadership roles is grades and scores, you know, college graduation rates, standardized test scores, high median income. Couldn't a reasonable person say, so what? I mean, there are a lot of successful people who never graduated from college. I mean, Bill Gates, Steve Jobs, Peter Jennings, newscasters like Brian Williams, Matt Lauer. Yes, they're all white men, but people would say, well, that's not a one-to-one correlation. So why is that the metric that's being used to say it should be this or that?
Because I think that is the narrative of the American way. I mean, it's this whole idea that if you study hard, if you work hard, that you will be rewarded. And I think there's a lot of people who are told, you know, get a good education and that will lead to success. And yes, it does lead to a certain measure of success for some people, not all people. And obviously, there are examples of those who have done very well without an education. I think what's sometimes out of context is that we don't know what the background of these people are. You know, where do they come from? I mean, Bill Gates came from a rather privileged background, and he had a number of other, I would say, advantages that perhaps, or privileges. You know, there's a lot of talk about privilege in this society, and especially privilege that is accorded to those who are particularly male and white.
Yeah, but we're talking about leadership. We're talking about a very narrow funnel, you know, of leadership. And then the question is whether or not there's a one-to-one correlation between achieving in one realm and being rewarded for it in another. I mean, Wesley, you wrote about this, so talk to me about it.
Clearly, there is no one-to-one correspondence between grade-based meritocracy, which is a very sort of narrow approach to who is better and who is worse based upon metrics that are easily quantifiable, and leadership, which is based upon metrics that are not so easily quantifiable. And one big part of that equation is, to what extent are you able to give social comfort to the people that are already in dominant positions in American corporations? And a lot of the sort of Asian leadership training, including the work that LEAP does, is all about sort of casting that question as a set of cultural competencies and skills that can actually be taught. So like any person that wants to be sort of a candidate for elevation into leadership has to have three things happen. They have to attract the notice, they have to receive the mentorship, and they have to win the sponsorship of somebody who is already in that arena. And contrary to any rumors that might be floating around on the internet about the decline or eclipse of the straight white American male, this group is still overwhelmingly the dominant force in just about every institution of American life, particularly Fortune 500 America.
So you're saying that, well, but you also in your piece, which is quite lengthy and complex, you wrote a very lengthy piece in New York Magazine about this a while ago, I want to sort of mention that it's a very complex and kind of nuanced piece, but you also talk about there are some upbringing factors that you think also may play a role. Do you want to talk about that? As I say, you ask yourself the hard questions, so I think we should
all be asking.
What about that?
I mean, look, this is an explicit part of what LEAP does in its training with Asian professionals, which is that, you know, they involve them in this process of introspection where they ask them to say, what are the sort of terms that come to mind? What are our associations, you know, from Asian culture, and what are the norms and expectations that we understand to be the case for leaders in corporate America, and what they show is that there's almost no overlap between these two terms. So it may well be the case that many Asian professionals arrive in the workplace with a set of culturally ingrained sets of what is appropriate behavior, ways to relate themselves to superiors and to elders, that may well be a recipe for invisibility.
Yeah, like not hanging out with people after work, focusing on the substance, not the social relationships,
or
things of that sort.
All of the above.
And a lot of it is even just not even bragging about how, you know, all the good stuff that they're doing, you know, all the work that they're producing. A lot of Asian Americans are taught, you know, you just work hard and you keep your nose to the grindstone and you will be recognized.
So
you don't have to talk about yourself.
So not wanting to make anybody's head spin off their neck, I'm going to ask you the Oprah question, which is, you know, oftentimes when people complain about disparities among African Americans, that people say, well, Oprah, you know, or Barack Obama. And so let me ask you, Linda, why don't I give you the final word here? What would success look like?
I think success is, you know, just being able to not make it a surprise that we see someone who's Asian American or even of a person of color, someone who's diverse, and it just not be such a big deal. I mean, it should be just part and parcel of just what we see, and people come, people go. We know that that's corporate life, but at the same time, we want to be able to see, you know, folks be able to really be able to compete and achieve and really have their chance at leading these companies.
Optimistic or pessimistic about that?
I think there are exceptions right now, and I think there are those who are I won't say fortunate, but have done well. But I think there, in some ways right now, that's still the exception to the rule. I think there's still a lot of ground to be broken, and I think I'm going to try to be as optimistic as possible, but I think it's still going to take a while.
All right. Linda Akutagawa is the president and CEO of Leadership Education for Asian Pacifics, or LEAP. She was kind enough to join us from our studios at NPR West, which are in Culver City, California. Wesley Yang is a freelance writer. He joined us from his home office in New York City. Thank you both so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, the Catholic Church has been criticized for years from within and without for mishandling sexual abuse allegations within its ranks. Now other denominations are confronting the same issue, and advocates say they want to learn from the Catholic Church and do better.
They need to be willing to let these facts come to light, because that is the most powerful and healing things for victims.
Journalist Catherine Joyce has looked into this, and she's telling us more. That's just ahead on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
On the next Fresh Air, we listen back to an interview with cinematographer Gordon Willis, who shot The Godfather, The Godfather Part II, Manhattan, Annie Hall, and All the President's Men. Willis died Sunday at the age of 82. Also, an excerpt of our interview with Donovan. He's about to be inducted into the Songwriters Hall of Fame. Join us.
Weekdays at 11 a.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
Support comes from Bodywork Associates, offering professional, licensed massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982. Two locations, including inside the Activities and Recreation Center, north of Memorial Stadium on the U of I campus, and on Windsor Road in Champaign. More information is at bodyworkassociates.com.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Now it's time for Faith Matters. That's the part of the program where we talk about matters of faith, religion, and spirituality. And today we want to take a closer look at how one faith community dealt with allegations of sexual abuse within its ranks. Now, of course, the Catholic Church has been in the headlines for years for its handling or mishandling of this issue in congregations around the world. But evangelical and other Protestant groups have also confronted this issue, of course, of the sexual abuse of young people. Catherine Joyce wrote about this for the American Prospect in a piece titled By Grace Alone, and she's with us now from our bureau in New York. Catherine Joyce, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And I do want to say that this might be the type of issue that is not appropriate for all listeners. So with that being said, I think a lot of people, as I said, are familiar with the allegations of sexual abuse and how that unfolded in the Catholic Church around the world. Talk about what prompted Bob Jones University, which is a very important evangelical institution, to look at this issue within its own community.
Absolutely. Well, Bob Jones University, which is based in Greenville, South Carolina, is considered by many to be the flagship institution of fundamentalist Christianity. If you are a more fundamentalist Christian in this country, Bob Jones would be one of the top choices that you would consider sending your children to. And it's a school with more a presence that really dwarfs that of a normal university. It's tied to thousands of churches across the country. It has a network of affiliated feeder schools that send children there. In some ways, Bob Jones's influence is so great that it almost functions as a denomination in terms of how people affiliate themselves with the school and its corresponding institutions. But a couple of years ago, in 2011, a story came out on 2020 that for many people within that broad Bob Jones community made them really think about how the school was responding to allegations of rape or sexual abuse. And it was a story actually that didn't take place at Bob Jones University, but instead at a church up in New Hampshire. There, about 15 years before, a teenage girl had been raped and impregnated by a deacon in her church. And when she became pregnant and her mother took her to the pastor, rather than help the family go to report this to the police or take some sort of other action, this young woman, this teenage girl, was made to stand before her congregation while her pastor read a confession, and then she was sent out of state away from her family. So when this came out years later...
Well, it's not just that, but you also reported that the rapist, who was a registered sex offender, was also made to confess, but to adultery.
Yes,
and not rape.
Absolutely.
And he remained at the church. He was
and
able to stay.
He remained at the church while she was sent away. Absolutely. And when this came out 15 years later, people were looking at this and they were looking at the pastor involved in this, the pastor who made the decision of how to handle this. And it turns out he was a Bob Jones graduate, for starters, but not just that. He also served on the board of trustees for the school, as well as two other affiliated Bob Jones boards. So here was a man who was, you know, very much enmeshed in the leadership of the school, and this is how he had chosen to deal with the rape of a minor girl, by seeming to punish the girl and allow the man who raped her to go unpunished.
Was this just the edge of the spear, or had there been other examples like this that got people within the evangelical Protestant world, or particularly people connected to Bob Jones, saying that this is not okay? Were there other things, or was this the straw that broke the camel's back, or were there other things too?
Well, there were definitely other things. I think this really just became a galvanizing moment because it became so visible, because it became such a national story. But there was already a community of Bob Jones alumni who were starting to raise a lot of questions about how the school handled sexual assault or rape or sexual harassment, as well as a number of other issues on the school in terms of academic or student freedom. But particularly with regards to how the school handled sexual offenses, the Tina Anderson story really hit a chord. And a lot of people started talking about, you know, something similar happened to my roommate, something similar happened to myself, that they had been sexually assaulted while they were on campus at Bob Jones University, or they had been raped or molested years before they went to the school. But while they were there, they went to people in the administration, they went to their deans, they went to their counselors, because Bob Jones has, you know, a very kind of regimented counseling and discipline system. And when they went to those counselors, frequently they were counseled not to go to the police, not to make any report or share this with their family, and in some cases even told that their rape was based on a sin in their own life, and that they had to dig deep and figure out what that sin was before they could confront the fact that they had been sinned against.
But the story doesn't end there. I mean, and that's one of the things that you wrote about, that Bob Jones, after the story became a national story, they hired a group called Grace, which had investigated allegations of sex abuse in two Christian missionary groups. And you say in the piece, it's hard to overstate the significance of this hire. So tell me why.
Grace, it's short for Godly Response to Abuse in the Christian Environment. And this is very much an evangelical Christian group. It is peopled by lawyers, pastors, psychologists, theologians, who are all volunteering to be a part of this organization that has taken as its mission to find a way to encourage Christian institutions, Christian churches, to be part of the solution for child sex abuse rather than part of the problem, as too often they say they are. This group, who they're headed by, really kind of makes Bob Jones' hire really extraordinary, because this Grace was started by a man named Boz Trevigian, who is the grandson of Billy Graham, who probably all listeners know. You know, he was called America's pastor. He is one of the most well-known evangelists in American history. And Billy Graham historically had a very interesting falling out with Bob Jones Sr., the founder of Bob Jones University. Graham had gone to Bob Jones University. He had been kicked out. Bob Jones had told him he would never amount to more than a poor country preacher somewhere out in the sticks. And though the two later became friends, they split again because Billy Graham was seen by Bob Jones Sr. as being too ecumenical, too accommodating to modern society. And that split really became a dividing line between what we now know as evangelicals and fundamentalist Christians.
So fast forwarding here for people who are not as acquainted with kind of the backstory. So it was an important thing because there had been this rift, but it's also important as an acknowledgement that there was a problem. Was there not? I mean, to say
Absolutely.
That we're going to confront this as opposed to pretend it wasn't there.
Absolutely. So, it was Bob Jones, this famously insular university, reaching outside of itself to another institution, to another group, to say, come and investigate us, see how we've done wrong. And really, that was a groundbreaking moment.
Well, what were some of the problems that Grace found at Bob Jones University? Did they find problems?
Well, first I should say that Grace has not yet released its report. Its report should be due out this summer. But I know from speaking to a number of people who did speak with Grace, we can get a sense of some of the issues that they shared. So starting at the very end of 2012 and beginning of 2013, Grace started doing interviews with dozens of former students and staff and alumni, and they were talking mostly about Bob Jones University's response to sexual abuse and rape. And they found a number of patterns, as I mentioned before, that students were frequently counseled not to report to the police, that many of them received counseling that suggested that they were at fault or that there was some sin in their life that had led to their assault or to their rape, that kind of the counseling structure seemed to protect perpetrators or accused offenders and re-victimize people who were coming forward with these stories. And these stories started to come out. People were talking about them a little bit online. And then in January, Grace announced publicly in one of its kind of customary updates on its website that it was almost done with a review and it was almost done with interviewing and it would soon start to write its final report. And then a few weeks later, there was this stunning news that Bob Jones University fired Grace. It came out of nowhere, but they sent them a termination letter and said that they were letting them go and that they wanted to meet to renegotiate new terms for a new contract.
Hmm. So what do you think all this means?
Well, I think, you know, I'll just kind of take the point from Grace and Boz Trevigian himself that the sort of scandal we saw in the Catholic Church, we're now starting to see so many sex abuse scandals in so many evangelical and Protestant churches that it's almost becoming a crisis of the same magnitude. And that I think for many Christians who are not Catholics, you know, they've long looked at the Catholic Church scandal and thought, you know, this is an issue of celibate priests. This is not an issue that we're going to have to deal with. But increasingly we're seeing, you know, just in the number of scandals that have arisen just in the past 12 months in evangelical and other Protestant Christian institutions, we're starting to see so many cases that we're really lining up for an evangelical Protestant sex abuse scandal.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with author and journalist Catherine Joyce. We're talking about her reporting on efforts to address sexual abuse in the evangelical Protestant church. Her piece is called By Grace Alone. Following on the point that you just made, that there are people outside of the Catholic Church who'd say, well, this is a structural problem of the Catholic Church. This is a problem of celibacy. This is a problem of these men of kind of a sexual maturation and, you know, being all sort of being together or not knowing a lot about the outside world or not having a release for their feelings or, you know, all kinds of things that a lot of people have outside of the Catholic Church have liked to attribute to this, the particularities of the way the Catholic Church is structured. That's not the case here. You know, for the most part, they're, those facts don't apply. I mean, there are some people who choose a celibate lifestyle, but it's certainly not, you know, required. Right. So did you identify or did Grace identify any through line in the kinds of places where this kind of thing was likely to take place? And I do right. want to say that you identify some really disturbing behavior in your article. And I we're kind of glossing over a little bit, but we can't, because the fact is that you're talking about people using their religious authority, in some cases over very young people, to manipulate them into doing things that are not healthy for them, not appropriate for them, and can have lasting scars. I mean, so I just want to be sure that I understand, that I let people understand that do detail all of this in this report, which we don't. So, right. So did you see any through line around the kinds of places where this kind of thing was likely to take place?
Absolutely. Well, Grace is now working on its third report, the Bob Jones report, after the school hired them back. That should be out this summer. But in the other two reports that they've worked on, all three of them, we can see issues that arose in terms of authoritarian cultures, where there was a strict hierarchy in place, and you know, people at the lower ranks of that hierarchy were not in a position to ask questions or, you know, really to kind of fight back. There was a lot of what you were just speaking about, which is something that Grace refers to as spiritual abuse, manipulating one's faith, a child's faith or a young woman's faith or a young man's faith, to make them participate in abuse that's obviously not helpful for them, or to cover it up, that the spiritual abuse was a large part of this. But also, I think, whether we're talking about in mission fields where children were abused at the hands of missionaries who, you know, as you mentioned, were not celibate, but were married with children of their own, or at Bob Jones University, where people were coming to administrators with stories of things they'd experienced before they got there, a lot of times it was, you know, this authoritarian structure, which just kind of, in a way, helped cover up this abuse, helped silence victims. And also, an interesting thing I want to note just before we go is one of Grace's main points, which is that churches in many ways and religious communities, they tend to have a lot of abuse in them, not because believers are inherently more abusive, but because kind of the structure of a Christian church and its, you know, its mission to be opening to new converts, to welcome new believers, makes it also particularly vulnerable to people who want to take advantage of that openness and trust.
Chavijan is quoted in your piece as saying, well, you paraphrase him, saying he fears it's only a matter of time before this all blows up in their faces and threatens the survival of powerful Protestant institutions. So what kinds of strategies is Grace and the leaders of this movement advocating for congregations right. to try to correct this pattern or to guard against this?
Right. Well, Grace does an awful lot of abuse prevention trainings and seminars at churches and ministries all around the country. So prevention, I think, is a huge part of their work. But in terms of abuse that has already happened, Grace's model is really interesting. When I was reporting on this, I kept thinking of it as something akin to a Truth and Reconciliation Committee. That's not quite the metaphor that they use, but in a way, what they're talking about is an idea of radical truth, that institutions that have, you know, witnessed abuse in their ranks and all too often have responded in the wrong way by silencing victims, by discouraging people from coming forward to law enforcement, that they need to be willing to let these facts come to light, because that is the most powerful and healing things for victims, and that they need to, here he's making very much a theological point, but that if they are the believers they say they are, that they need to not be worried so much about their reputation and instead be worried about basically doing the right thing and allowing these facts to come to light. And kind of as a side benefit to that, Boz says that oftentimes victims are not looking for a settlement first and foremost. Really what they're looking for is an acknowledgement within their community that this happened and that this was wrong, and some sincere gesture of repentance. So for a lot of Protestant institutions that could be facing very serious lawsuits in the same way that the Catholic Church has faced humongous lawsuits that in some cases have bankrupted dioceses across this country, Grace is saying, If you come forward, if you let these facts come to light, you might also have kind of the side benefit of discouraging people from going and pressing very expensive lawsuits.
That was Catherine Joyce. You can read her piece by Grace Alone in The American Prospect. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Coming up, Los Angeles Clippers owner Donald Sterling has been vilified by the public and the NBA for racist comments, but Dallas Mavericks owner Mark Cuban says that Sterling does not hold a monopoly on bigotry.
I know that I'm not perfect. I know that I live in a glass house, and it's not appropriate for me to throw stones.
We'll ask the Barbershop guys if Cuban was dropping knowledge or dropping the ball on the Sterling controversy. That's just ahead on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Kauffman Foundation, educating startups through the Kauffman Founders School, online at entrepreneurship.org. From the Pew Charitable Trusts, driven by the power of knowledge to solve today's most challenging problems at pewtrusts.org. From the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting solutions to prevent and end homelessness, on the web at melvilletrust.org. And from the estate of Joan Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio. This is NPR.
We came up short of our goals during the last two radio pledge drives. That's added some extra urgency to our fiscal end-of-year fundraising. Fortunately, two friends of WILL want to jumpstart our June fundraising with the single biggest challenge gift in our history. They will donate $40,000 if other friends of WILL contribute $20,000 on Monday, June 2nd. Can you help? For more information or to make your June Jumpstart gift, go to will.illinois.edu/June Jumpstart.
Goodbye, Mom. Goodbye to you, too.
I'm Robin Young. It's that time again. Get ready for the graduation rite of passage song with Tom Rush.
It's such a true song. I mean, it's so simple, but it's not an easy song to record.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
Weekdays starting at noon on AM 580.
Today's programming is made possible in part by the Friends of WILL. And by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, inviting audiences to enjoy Krannert Uncorked, a weekly free wine tasting almost every Thursday at 5 p.m. in the lobby. For more information, visit KrannertCenter.com.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Now it's time for our weekly visit to the barbershop, where the guys talk about what's in the news and what's on their minds. Sitting in the chairs for a shape-up this week, our writer Jimmy Israel with us from Cleveland. Arsalan Iftikhar, founder of themuslimguide.com, is with us from Chicago. In New York City, Kevin Williamson, roving correspondent at the National Review. And here in Washington, D.C., Paul Butler, law professor at Georgetown University. Take it away, Jimmy.
Thank you, Michelle. K-Dub, what's
well,
up,
happy
man?
Happy World Turtle
Yo,
Day.
Guess what day it is? It's Shop Day! Mm-hmm. Welcome to the shop. How we doing?
Hey, what's happening?
Real good. Oh, my apologies to Chris Sullivan, the actual voice of the Geico Camel. Let's get it rocking. All right, so as it turns out, Dallas Mavericks owner Mark Cuban stirred things up this week with his comments about the whole Donald Sterling controversy. He didn't exactly defend the Clippers owners for making racist remarks, but he did say this. Drop that tape, please.
I mean, we're all prejudiced in one way or the other. If I see a black kid in a hoodie and it's late at night, I'm walking to the other side of the street. And if on that side of the street there's a guy that has tattoos all over his face, white guy, bald head, I'm walking back to the other side of the street.
Wowzers. Cuban did tweet an apology to the family of Trayvon Martin because of the whole black kid in a hoodie comment, but otherwise, he stood by his words. You know, I'm okay with Cuban. I wouldn't eat ribs with him, but I mean, I'm okay
yes,
with him.
Yes, you would. Because he'd be
buying. I would not. I don't eat ribs with one man, hashtag Charles Ramsey. But it's like this here. You know, at least he's being honest about his biases. You know, we all need to step outside of our comfort zone to deal with some of these prejudices. K-Dub, how about you? Not to put you on the spot or anything, but go ahead.
Well, first of all, when he's talking about being afraid of walking down the street and seeing a white guy with a shaved head and tattoos, I'm coming after you,
I was going to say,
Mark
that
Cuban.
Would be you, right? That would be K-Dub. Me.
You know, I mean,
snap.
True.
This is sort of such a sad, you know, pat me on the head for being an enlightened guy sort of, you know, outburst. I mean, this sort of near universality of prejudice, which I think everyone acknowledges to some extent, doesn't tell us anything at all about this particular case with Sterling and what the NBA should do about it. So it's just, you know, Cuban out there saying, you know, look at me. I'm an enlightened guy. Love me.
Yeah, you're probably right about that. Paul Butler, you step up, man. What about your biases, man? And not to put you on blast, but maybe.
Well, maybe, yeah, because everybody has prejudices. And, you know, if I were a billionaire like Mark Cuban, I might even say what mine are. But I try to work on them. You can actually go online, just Google implicit bias, and you can take a test to see, you know, stuff that's inside your head that you don't even know about. You know, when I'm driving and somebody cuts me off, sometimes things come out. I don't like it, but it's real.
I love it.
So, you know, it's real, man. So I'm glad that Mark Cuban put it out there. I'm not a Mark Cuban fan, but it took courage to say what he said.
Paul Butler with the great pivot off the question. A-Train, Arsalan Iftikhar. Come with it. What are your biases, bro?
Well, first of all, you know, I don't think Mark Cuban has to walk anywhere in his life. I mean, he could take his Gulfstream private jet from his bathroom to his kitchen. So I think that needs to be said. But I do applaud him for, you know, acknowledging the fact that we do all have unconscious biases. And, you know, it's something that, you know, in my work as a diversity consultant with corporations and organizations, we talk about. My only issue, of course, was with his hoodie reference. I love hoodies. I'm actually wearing a hoodie under my sport coat right now. And I think that triggered people to the Trayvon Martin incident. We all remember Geraldo Rivera when he, you know, first brought the hoodie into the national limelight. And I think that for some people in America, myself included, it was a raw nerve, and it struck a nerve in that a hoodie is an inanimate object, you know, like a roller coaster. A roller coaster is neither fun nor scary. And a hoodie is also an inanimate object. It's the context within which it's used. So if I, as a brown man or a white man, were wearing a hoodie, Mark Cuban wouldn't cross the street, but he said if a black kid was wearing a hoodie, he would cross the street. And so I think it's these triggers that we have to talk about in our unconscious biases and the content and the context of the biases that we have that's really important.
So do you think he did the right? Are you glad he spoke up or not? Are you thinking that because Kevin's saying this is bogus. This is just kind of love me, you know, love my dog situation where he's kind of fishing for approval, which is not really his. What do you say?
Well, you know, as a basketball fan, you know, Mark Cuban has, you know, never met a television camera that he didn't like. You know, let's be honest with that. And I think he was mentioning an uncomfortable truth in light of the Donald Sterling situation. I think, sadly, now he is going to be the story, and Donald Sterling will sort of be relegated to the back burners.
But let me just one thing, though. I want to talk about what this whole implicit bias question. I mean, I think, Paul, you brought that up. For people who are interested in digging into this more, The Post has something on this today. Anthony Greenwald is professor of psychology at the University of Washington in Seattle, and he's a co-author of Blind Spot, The Hidden Biases of Good People. He's been studying this for 20 years, and he's got something called the Implicit Association Test, and people can take this test online if they want to, and millions of people have taken it so far. And he says that what Cuban is saying is true. He's found in his research that about 75% of white Americans and almost exactly the same percentage of Asian Americans have something that they call an automatic white preference in a test that compares white and black faces. And a higher proportion have an automatic young preference. And a lot of people have gender stereotypes and associate women less with careers than men and women less with science. And so I guess the point is that there is a lot of that in a lot of us. And so the question then becomes, I think, what have you acted upon it? And what are you going to do about it once you recognize it in yourself? And are those implicit biases affecting other people's life chances? And I think that's the question, and which is where it goes back to, you know, Donald Sterling. I mean, is there some evidence that Mark Cuban has acted on these biases in a way that has redounded to the detriment of people in his sphere? And is he addressing that? That's kind of where I'd like to go with it. So you have your feelings, but what are you doing about it is the question. If it's hurting someone, that's what my question would be. So, all right, anyway. Do you want to go?
Well,
okay, I've just stunned you into silence. Go ahead.
You know,
I'm just surprised the number is only 75%. I would think it would be more like 97%.
Why do you say that, though? No, Kevin, why? Cyrus, seriously, why?
Well,
why?
Just simply because stereotypes and prejudice about things like sex and ethnicity and religion and other sorts of demographic features are just, you know, darn near universal, and not just in the United States. I mean, it's true in Mexico, it's true in India, it's true in Japan, it's true in China. It just seems to be a naturally occurring part of the human psyche.
Except that you can train yourself. Lots of things are naturally occurring, which is what education is about, and manners and things of that
Well,
sort.
Yeah, and certainly you want to try to teach people to be better than they are, but the number of things that people have biases about, of course, isn't limited to demographic features. We have all sorts of biases about, you know, the way the world works. We have false ideas about. Brian Kaplan from George Mason University wrote a wonderful book called The Myth of the Rational Voter about sort of documentably false ideas people have about the way the world works and how they act on it through politics. So, I mean, there's one of those things. And as much as I personally aspire to be a sort of, you know, Spock-type character, most people don't have the time or the inclination to try to rationally think through every aspect of their lives. I mean, that's the reason that prejudices really develop as a form of social shorthand, even though defective as they are, as a way of not having to think through from the beginning every situation you come into.
Sure. And it certainly doesn't help when media act as a feedback loop to represent, you know, to replicate people's false ideas. That certainly doesn't help, does it? Yeah. So, go ahead,
Michelle,
Jimmy. Do your thing.
Speaking of the way the world works, there's a new term being thrown about. It's called trigger warning. I don't know what that's about.
Yes, you do.
I heard it. I've heard it in the hood, but I haven't heard it on the radio. It's a term being tossed about college campuses. You know, the ideas for professors to warn students if textbooks, lectures, or pastry or other class materials cover issues that may upset or offend them. You know, Paul Butler, you and I both teach on college campuses, and maybe a few others of you. A-Train, you're doing DePaul, my man. Pop that collar. Yo, well, what – Kate, but Paul, you're up first. What do you think? Do you support the whole trigger warning thing?
I think it's important to be sensitive to the ways that some materials can be sensitive for students. I deal with this issue in my criminal law class when I teach rape law. So I know I have students in the class who've been victims, as well as students who may have been falsely accused about doing things that they didn't do. So I do something like a trigger warning. And I also remember what it was like when I was in high school and we read Huckleberry Finn. And it was a mainly white class where I was one of the few African Americans. And students, in discussing the book, would say the N-word over and over, kind of putting it in my face. So I don't think it's being overly politically correct to understand that there's some very emotional, even traumatic issues for students that come up in the classroom.
What do you do? Do you say, I recognize this will be difficult for some of you, so what you just need to know this, or what do you do? You don't, yeah. They can't opt out of it though, right? If you're going to take criminal law, you have to at some point talk about it, right?
You do. So sometimes I tell students, because I call in students at random, we use the Socratic method in law school, so you don't know in advance whether you're going to get called on. So I tell students, if this is a particularly difficult subject, come during office hours and we can talk about it. And sometimes I'll have victims say that they don't want to be called on, and other times I'll have victims say, I do want to be called on. This is something that I want to engage in the classroom because it happened to me, and this is another way of processing it.
Hmm. It shows that there's no one-size-fits-all answer to this. Well, what about other folks? Right. I mean, I don't know. Arsalan, you're teaching now. What do you think about this?
Well, you know, when I read the story, I immediately thought of movie trailers, right? I thought of the Motion Picture Association of America, and when you get the movie rating system now, when you see the green band trailers, they'll tell you if there's, you know, graphic nudity, strong sexual content, prolific drug use. And I think that, you know, if you're dealing with literature that deals with, you know, hot-button issues like race or incest or, you know, racist terms, I don't think it's necessarily inherently a bad thing to be able to, you know, highlight that beforehand so that people know going in what sort of material they'll be reading. I think that, again, I think it's no different than the Motion Picture Association of America in their rating system.
Kevin, I think, has a different view of this.
Yeah, well, you know, we were talking about biases earlier. In addition to my bias against people involved in professional sports and diversity consultants, I hate college students, and I say this as a guy who taught college for a while. You know, when I was a kid, we were protesting against warning labels on things like rap albums and rock and roll records, and now we have kids out there who are demanding warning labels because they are too soft to handle a poem. You know, I'm telling you, if you're going to college and you're actually trying to get yourself a literary education and you feel like you need a warning label before you read Finnegan's Wake or Ulysses, you're doing the wrong thing with your life. Mm. You should be out doing something else, because if you can't handle a novel without a warning label, if you can't handle Mark Twain without a warning label, there's something intellectually defective about you, and you should just stop trying to pursue a literary education.
Would it be too terrible, though, to say... I mean, we do this on this program in part because we feel like you might be a captive audience, right? You might just be, you might be driving along, or you might be sitting there in carpool, and something comes along that we say, here's something coming up, might not be for you. Is that wrong?
Good Lord, life sucks. Get a helmet. Grow up.
Nice. Thank okay. you, Professor K-Dub.
Is there anything that pushes your buttons, Kevin, that would hurt you if somebody just hit you over the head with it without warning?
There's all sorts of things that push my buttons. I mean, listen to what I have to say every day and what I write about. My buttons are getting pushed all the time. If my buttons weren't getting pushed, I wouldn't get out of bed in the morning. But so what? That's what happens. It's living life in a free society with lots of different kinds of people with lots of different ideas.
But if you're trying to teach people, you have to be sensitive to where students are. And again, if you want them to get the lesson, you know, you got to be sensitive in the way you teach it. Again, I don't think it's being too sensitive. It's the real world.
Especially if you want to teach them sort of difficult ideas about things like mm-hmm. literature and history and politics, you need to be insensitive to them. You need to run over their little prejudices and their little preferences and their little sentimentality and all the emotional crap they grew up with, and hit them with what's actually going on. Hit them with the material. And if they're not ready for it, so much the better. Actually, sometimes that produces a good reaction in someone.
Yeah, I mean, it's tough love. It doesn't always work in the classroom, because I'll have students crying, students wanting to leave the classroom. And, you know, obviously they're not going to get this lesson if they're not present, either physically or emotionally.
I always look forward to making my students cry, but maybe that's just me.
It's you.
I do want to say this one point that I do believe that college is about challenging students with new ideas that may hurt them. I believe that. I think that's the point.
Okay, well, that's why we have different views on it. It's good to hear. It's interesting. Okay, we have a couple minutes here, from politically correct campuses to politically correct fashion. I'm not sure if you like that phrase, but Levi CEO Chip Berg said people should conserve water by washing their jeans less often. He says he's setting the example. Here's a clip of him explaining this at a sustainability conference.
These are one of my favorite jeans. These jeans are maybe a year old, and these have yet to see a washing machine. I know that sounds totally disgusting. I know it does, but believe me, it can be done. You can spot clean it, you can air dry it, and it's fine. I have yet to get a skin disease or anything else. It works.
Or a date, because I'm sorry, I just have to ask the guys, because we had a lively conversation around this at our conference table, and like all the women started moving back from the table. So anyway, Paul, I'll ask you first.
I would never wash my jeans. My jeans are way too expensive to wash. I get them dry cleaned.
Okay. Well, that's bougie if there ever was. All right, wow. Kevin, what about you?
You calling me bougie?
Kind of, yeah. Kevin,
you... Dang, he just stole my line. I actually buy fairly fancy jeans, too, and they have to be dry cleaned as well.
They have to be dry cleaned.
Wow. Man. Although, actually, I send all my stuff out for that because I'm actually too lazy to do it myself.
That's right. You bougie, too. All right, Arsalan, what about you? Not to wash those jeans.
Well, for me, it's interesting. I don't wash my jeans very often for a different reason, is that I'm 6'4" with about 4 feet of legs, and so every time I wash my jeans, the length shrinks, and ultimately they'll turn out to look like Steve Urkel high waters. And so... You know, I have to be. You know, I have to make sure that I get like 36 length jeans because of my height. So I don't wash my jeans very often because of the fact that they'll shrink in length.
You just throw them out when they're dirty, right? Buy more.
Yeah, because I buy $20 jeans from Old Navy.
Okay, well, Jimmy, what about you?
Yo, I know if this cat walked in my house with some year old jeans that he hadn't washed, smelling like fried chicken and kitty litter, that would be a fight. That would be a fight, straight up, B. But personally, I wear Levi's 550s. They get washed after every wear, and that's the way, I like it.
All right, okay. Again, a diversity of views. I like it. Jimmy Israel is a writer. You can find his blog at jimmyisrael.com. Kevin Williamson is a roving correspondent with the National Review. He's with us from NPR member station WGVU, which is in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Paul Butler is a law professor at Georgetown. Arsalan Iftikhar is founder of themuslimguide.com and an adjunct professor of religious studies at DePaul University. Paul was here with me in Washington, D.C. Arsalan, where are you?
Chicago.
You're in Chicago. Member station BEZ. Thanks for joining us.
Peace.
Pretty sure I'm not in Michigan.
Right.
Yep.
And remember, if you can't get in a Barbershop Buzz on the radio, look for our Barbershop podcast. That's in the iTunes store or at npr.org. That's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News and the African American Public Radio Consortium. Let's talk more on Monday.